Welcome to the Hamilton Spectator's Newsroom Insider podcast. My name is Scott Radley. I'm going to be the host for this week's edition of the podcast. We are going to be today talking about those events in the world of sports that you probably wish you'd been there for, that you wish you had a ticket stub that said, yeah, I was in Atlanta for the Jays' first World Series. I was at Sky Dome when Joe Carter hit the home run. I was at that Grey Cup or that Olympic event or whatever else. Because Steve Milton, Spectator columnist Steve Milton, has been at many of those things, and he started a new feature that runs in Fridays in the paper about those moments, these stories behind the stories. We'll talk with Steve about that. And first up, when we come back, Graham McKay is the guy who draws the editorial cartoons you see every day in The Spectator. But how do you draw Donald Trump? And when you draw Donald Trump, how much flack do you get from those who support him, and how much love do you get from those who hate him? Graham McKay, first up when we come back. I've long held that the most difficult job at this newspaper, maybe in the entire city, potentially in this entire country from coast to coast, is that of editorial cartoonist, mostly because it's something I'm completely incapable of doing, so it seems hard, but you've got to be able to draw. That would seem to be a basic underlying thing. Then you got to be funny. Then you got to be on top of the news. Again, I'm incapable of any of those things, but a guy who is Graham McKay, who is the Spec's editorial cartoonist, who joins me now.
Pleasure to be here.
Are you okay with being identified as a guy who has the hardest job in Canada?
In Canada?
You'll accept that, right? When you go home to your wife and you've had a hard day, say, I have the hardest job in Canada.
I do sometimes use that excuse, yes.
I would.
You try doing what I do.
I would.
For a living.
Brain surgery? Pfft. Try drawing a cartoon of Fred Eisenberger.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
it can be challenging.
I want to talk about the blowback you get from some of your stuff in just a minute. But first, the thing that I think is that I find really interesting, I want to walk through a few of the people who you have to draw regularly now because they are in the news all the time.
And yes.
Give us the sort of the starting point or the dominant characteristic when you went about trying to figure out how to draw these people. And I think we would be way off base if we started anywhere other than Donald Trump. So when Donald Trump was running and he got into the U.S. election and you sat down to draw your first Donald, you may have drawn Donald Trump before.
Mm.
When you started doodling and putting together a Donald Trump, where do you start? Is it the hair?
I think you start with your pencil crayon, which is orange, naturally. The guy's got orange skin, but I've noticed his skin isn't as orange anymore. He's lessened the skin tone. He's more pink. But the hair is typically a natural starting spot for Donald Trump, yeah.
And as you draw him more and more, because you do draw him a lot, you have to.
Yeah. Can I give you a statistic, actually?
Yes.
In 8 years, when Barack Obama was present, I drew 70 cartoons. I've already drawn 68 of Donald Trump.
Is that right?
And he's been only around since June of last year.
And I imagine that as you do this, that it morphs. Like, how different is the Donald Trump that you draw now compared to the Donald Trump that when you first did him? Because it has to become more, things have to become more exaggerated. With Barack Obama, I may be wrong, but his ears became much more prominent as he went along. Well, what is it with Trump? How has he changed?
I think with any politician, you do have to get, you know, the nuances, and the politicians sort of take on their own sort of caricature as time goes on. So when you go back to the beginning of any sort of caricature, they're very realistic. They're almost
portraits.
They're almost like tracings of photographs. And then as you go further along, then you exaggerate the eyebrows, the hair, the nose. So with Donald Trump, there's so many different characteristics that are so weird compared to you and I, but you know, he's a billionaire and he can do whatever he wants with his body, but with him, he is the gift to cartoonists, and it's always a pleasure to draw him.
You must look at other cartoonists.
Yeah.
Are you, this may be an odd question, are you happy with your Donald Trump?
I think I'm never happy. I'm never content with my caricatures because some some cartoonists do a very good job. Some are very realistic. I try to exaggerate as much as possible, but not too bizarre. Like some of these cartoonists go way over the top. Mm-hmm. By the time Obama was done his presidency, some cartoonists were basically making him into stick figures with ears. But Donald Trump is sort of middle right now. So catch me another 4 years and my caricatures of him could look totally different.
But do you look at other cartoonists and go, oh, I wish that was the Donald Trump that I had drawn? Or do you say, no, I'll be happy with mine.
I'm fine with how I draw him. I think when I draw him, it looks like him, I guess.
People can recognize him.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even need photo references right now if I were to draw one in front of you right now. But maybe that's a problem. Maybe we start doing caricatures of our caricatures and then in my mind, it looks like him. Other people might think, you could do a better job than that. But
it becomes like almost like in Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. When George Bush, mm-hmm. read my lips, Dana mm-hmm. Carvey, that had become the caricature of the caricature of
yes.
the caricature.
Yes.
Or Sarah Palin, I can see Russia from my yeah. backyard, which yeah. she never said, but that's...
No, of course.
The caricature gets caricaturized.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is Dana Carvey's Herbert Walker Bush was probably the best. And I would say it's even better than Alec Baldwin's Trump. And I think Alec Baldwin's Trump is actually... gone a little overboard, or not overboard, but
that's what happens.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right there. And now it's almost like, do we have to see another Alec Baldwin impression of Trump?
Let's come north of the border for a minute. You've also drawn a few, two or three, of Justin Trudeau over yeah. the last number of years. I think it may be more than two or three. Yeah. Again, you sit down to draw Justin Trudeau the first time. What is the feature that stands out? What's the thing that you immediately say, that's the essence of our prime minister?
I think his eyebrows.
His eyebrows?
His eyebrows stand out. I mean, look at his eyebrows.
I've never looked at his eyebrows. Not that I noticed.
He's got wonderful eyebrows for, I think he's 44 or 43, but he's got thick eyebrows. We haven't had eyebrows like that since Michael Ignatieff, sincerely.
I've never noticed Justin Trudeau's eyebrows, ever.
Well, take a look at them.
His hair? See, I would have thought it would have been his hair.
Everyone's got hair, but his hair... can look like an 18-year-old's hair. He's a very young-looking mid-40s guy.
Do you prefer drawing Justin Trudeau face-on or from the side? Because you also appear to have a great deal of fun with his profile.
I like to do him, I guess, on an angle. I tend to do that with most of my caricatures. It's far easier than the side view. Although the side view is, He's got a bit of an eagle nose, I guess you could say. His nose droops down quite a bit if you look at it. I've had to study his face quite a bit, and I tell you, he's it's something to have a prime minister with an actual jawbone, because we haven't had that in a long time either. If you look around as prime minister, they're all very fleshy, and that
back
makes
to Joe
very,
Clark.
Well, exactly. You might go back to his dad, who had cheekbones.
Even bigger, now that you say it. Didn't really have much of a jawline.
Our prime ministers have been very jowly.
Maybe that's a prerequisite. When the parties get together for their conferences, they have people in the back rooms going, who has the greatest jowls?
Exactly.
It's a very Nixonian, now that you say it.
Well, that's the great, great gift that we now have with our prime minister. He's not as fleshy. He's got eyebrows.
Give him
time.
He's
got great hair. He's got eyelashes. He's got a great nose.
And eyebrows, as you say.
And a jawline.
I don't know how much longer you're going to have to draw her, but Kathleen Wynne.
Yes.
I don't know if you will take this as an insult.
Uh-huh.
I hope not. But the longer you've been drawing Kathleen Wynne, the more she has begun to look like Orville Redenbacher.
Well, there's that. But I'm not the one who made that identity thing. That's become a bit of a meme in the background. But, Kathleen Wynne actually reminds me a lot of my late mother. She looks... They're almost the same. And my siblings have said the same thing. Whenever you draw Kathleen Wynne, she looks like mother. She's got like the total cheekbones and everything. And I had a chance to actually meet the premier last year in Toronto.
Did she know who you were?
Well, we were there for a cartoonist convention. She came to actually speak to us, which I hey, I'll credit her for coming into a room full of porcupines.
And she was familiar with your work?
Yeah. I was introduced to her. She knows my work. I've met her a couple times here at the Spectator when we've done Ed Board meetings. But I told her, please don't get rid of the glasses. She promised that she would not get rid of the glasses. And my wife was with me, and she happened to say, you know, you remind me of Graham's mother. It's like, what do you say? And what did the premier say? It was like speechless.
Thanks, hon. Yeah, you're really helping today.
Exactly. Yeah.
But after the glasses, what would... So, glasses, pantsuits for a while, although she... Now, you, to remind me, because we're going to talk about blowback, you did, if I recall correctly, you got some flack for the whole pantsuit thing at one time, did you not?
I think one of the first cartoons I did of the premiere was the transition between her and Dalton McGuinty. And I actually show Dalton McGuinty wearing a Kathleen Wynne mask. And by then, I don't think a lot of people really knew a lot about Kathleen Wynne, and I mean, she had a male body because it was Kathleen Wynne's mask on Dalton McGuinty's face. So
not
actually got a lot of flack.
Ones.
They didn't get the fact that she was wearing a red tie, and she had pants on, and she kind of looked like Hillary Clinton in a way with a pantsuit. But you know what? Kathleen Wynne doesn't wear a lot of pantsuits. She actually wears a lot of dresses. So.
But that's again, we go back to the idea of the stereotype of the caricature of the caricature. That's what
yeah exactly
was the beginning.
Well, people thought I was poking fun at her, you know, being a lesbian, and you know that was a serious issue. And they thought I was mocking her lesbian personality, and it had nothing to do with that. People just got sort of carried away with their own biases or their own caricature.
So after the glasses, then, what is the standard or the dominant feature when you're drawing Kathleen Wynne?
Cheekbones. She's got great cheekbones, believe it or not.
I've got to go look at these politicians, because Trudeau in the eyebrows and Wynne in the cheekbones.
Yeah.
Okay, let's bring it home. We got a few minutes left. Let's bring it home. Mayor Fred Eisenberger, who, again, over the years, he has, in your cartoons, has changed.
Yeah.
At one point, he's going to hate this comparison. He kind of looked like a mix between Lurch and the creature from the... I don't know.
Frankenstein.
From Frankenstein, yes. He's softened in your cartoons a little bit.
He has. And I'll say this. I haven't drawn him very much. Mm. And maybe for him, that must be good. But it means he's... You have to compare him to the last mayor that we've had. Roberti and I drew a lot of him because he was constantly in the headlines. We don't hear a lot about Mayor Fred in the headlines. So I've drawn him like a few times in the last year, but not a lot. And I think I drew him quite a bit in his first term. And you can go through my archives, and there's many, many. But since he became mayor and sort of has taken a low profile, there hasn't been a lot of satire directed towards him.
Okay, but not all of our councillors have taken a low profile, and you have drawn mm-hmm. council. Who is your favorite councillor to draw?
It used to be Sam Arula, but not so much anymore. I like doing Whitehead. I like doing Lloyd Ferguson. But then there's a lot of new guys that I haven't drawn at all, and... I don't know what that is. I think what happened was the last election, and this is more serious than anything, we had 33% of people vote, which told me people aren't really paying attention to local news.
And that's a key part of an editorial cartoon.
Yeah.
It has to be instantly recognizable what you're talking about without
exactly.
a deep explanation.
Yeah. And right now there's a big issue about lunches that Donna Skelly's brought up about, well, why are the taxpayers paying for lunches for city councilors during meetings? And I'm thinking, that is a good topic. And I did do something back in 2011 on that very issue when it came up. But now I'm thinking, do people really care? I think there are, but it really is small potatoes compared to a lot of more important things happening.
Well, and people are not going to laugh at an editorial cartoon if they don't know what the
story
behind it is.
Exactly, yeah.
Which, hence the 68 Donald Trump cartoons, because you don't have to do much explaining.
You know what? If I throw a Donald Trump on Twitter or Facebook or social media, I get instant replies from people. Something on free lunches, I get, you know, crickets.
So what, LRT would be the local thing you could automatically know you're going to get, or stadium?
Stadium is usually good because it's a sport issue, but if I go into something like ward boundary review, that will put me to sleep as I'm drawing. And I've told the big advocates of that issue, and it went on for the longest time. I thought, you guys are putting people to sleep. Come on. It's not going to happen. Anyway.
Does anybody who you draw ever come to you and say, can I have the original? Do you ever get people come and they want to frame it or put it up in their house? Because often there is a zing involved in it. So you would think somebody wouldn't necessarily want it because you've torpedoed them a little bit.
It depends. I think some of these, I've had a few provincial ministers ask for originals or for copies, but they're usually ministers who've never had a cartoon drawn of them ever before outside of Ontario plays. And for them to actually see like a bit of satire directed their way in a daily newspaper, you got to remember, we don't have as many cartoonists in this province anymore. So a lot of them don't get featured at all.
What about the other side? How often do you get someone who doesn't quite grasp that this is satire, it's a joke, it's intended to be a little prickly but funny at times? How many times do you get people write you, text you, tweet you, email you, and just blast Graham McKay for what you've done?
Not much now. We did when Mayor Bettina was mayor. But we're now living in an era of Donald Trump, and a lot of people are now being taught that satire comes with politics. It's part of the game. And every time he complains about satire, people are laughing at him because they're realizing this is what you get in a democracy. This is not an authoritarian state. So I think politicians realize that as well. And fortunately, you know, satire is still a very healthy game in this country, in this city, in this province as well.
You ever drawn a cartoon of one of your bosses?
Yes, but usually when they're on their way out.
No, it's the safest way to do it that way.
Exactly.
It's the last thing they see as they leave the building when firing powers are out of their hands.
And I usually don't get a thank you or anything.
That is Graham McKay. You can see his stuff every day in the Hamilton Spectator, and I'm not being funny when I say it is the hardest job and does the best job at the paper. I think it is something that requires an unbelievable level of talent, and there is nobody in this country that does it better, and I haven't just said that on the Spec podcast, because, I mean, I have to right here, but I've said it elsewhere before. I really believe he is the best in the country. Graham McKay, thanks for doing this.
All right, thank you, Scott.
So have you seen Being There? It's a great movie by Peter Sellers.
It's a great movie by Peter Sellers. It's a five-dimensional movie, right? It's not really
he likes
the
to watch
now.
Yeah, he likes to watch. But that's not what we're talking about today. No. We're talking about a different Being There. Every Friday in The Spectator for the last number of weeks and continuing on in perpetuity until the author passes away, probably.
Steve Which Milton. Will be at my typewriter a laptop recording.
Steve Milton, who you're the other voice you're hearing, is doing something called Being There. It does not involve Peter Sellers or Shirley MacLaine. And for those of you who think, what are they talking about? It just tells you how old we really are, keep referencing a 1970s movie. But it's a column every week about the things Steve has seen, the places he's been, the sports he's covered. It is a look back at some of the great stories that have happened in our lifetime because Steve has been there for most of them. And last week was about the figure skating judging fiasco that got huge response. Steve, are you surprised at all that years and years and years and years and years later people are still interested in this stuff?
It's a great question, Scott, because I have been. I've been wrestling with that in my head. First of all, cards on the table here. I didn't like the idea at first. I thought that maybe it might be living in the past too much and that we might miss the fact that the first syllable of the industry that we're in, new. But it was Jeff Day's idea, the sports editor of the Spectator, and it was a great idea because the response has been terrific. It doesn't mean you have to live back there. It's just a great memory. And he wanted it as much as possible, but personal experience. So sometimes it looks a little self-aggrandizing, because Jeff would send me back the story and say, there's not enough you in there. In other words, they want the stuff around it. That won't always be the case, because lots of times I was just there. There was no part of me involved in the thing. So if you're talking, let's say, about Donovan Bailey winning in 96, I was just there. I didn't have any, there were no other stories beyond it, but I can describe the atmosphere that was there. And that's what we did in the first piece, which was about the Daytona 500, the first time that Dale Jr. had won. And you know, I compared the whole thing to a country song, going to Daytona for the first time. What happened then? Because I'm sure...
Did you lose your girlfriend?
Well, no, that's the thing.
And
it was
you
a country song.
And...
No, the other... That was the line in the thing. That nobody stole a truck. The wife came back, and the dog was friendly. Nobody took it. And that's because Dale Earnhardt Jr. won it. It was one of those happy country songs. And I will swear... And this is, it really came across to me strongly there. A lot of people were so nostalgic and so almost confused that I think about half of them thought it was his dad who won. Because it was on the anniversary of the time his dad won, right? And you can't make this stuff up, only in stock car racing. So it's that kind of thing. We're going with one, Tom Cheek will be in there in the next level. There'll be some stuff. Because it's spring training, I want to try to focus a little bit. Brian Orser's 30th anniversary of winning, and that was big. We don't think of it so much now as big because so many of our men have done well since Brian. But prior to Brian, we hadn't won a men's world championship in 24 years.
Just figure skating.
Yeah, figure skating. For Brian Orser. So that could be part of it. I was backstage with him when he won. So that's the idea, is to sort of give you a little more broader look at sort of, you might remember only the bones. So we'll remind you of the bones, and we'll try to put a little flesh on it as well.
Why does it matter, though? And not your stories. They're great stories, but... People look and they say, well, why can you not just cover this stuff from your television set? And the times are changing in this industry, and sometimes you have to now because of cost. Why does it matter that a person is at an event rather than just
fullness,
observing it from a
depth,
far away?
Depth, fullness, continuity, number of dimensions. We talked right off the top about the number of dimensions involved. When you cover, and I'll agree with you, that's the way the business is going. We do an awful lot by phone now, too. And I don't do as much as many many reporters by phone. I like to meet the person, partly because I think you'll find out something different there. I mean, if you have powers of observation, which most of us in this industry do, and we probably have heightened powers of observation, you're going to pick up some things that you can't see because now you're re-editing, right? So it's seen first through the editing / focus of a camera and the people and the director. So already it's being edited for you. And now if I edit it again through my eyes, that's double distilling. That's my feeling on things. The practicality of the world today is that we don't go to as many things as we used to. We don't have the money for it, and partly because I think the money people feel that it's not necessary. Well, I think it's probably better journalism to go. I think you get more, but I think that's why you end up with the kind of tweets that you have that seem to be the norm in news now, which are pretty shallow. And you and I both grew up in an era when that wasn't the way it was reported. I'm not saying you can't make changes, but what I'm saying is it's better to be there because you'll see more of a 360, and I think that's what this series is, in a way, intended to prove.
Double distilling. Great in bourbon, not so much in
no,
sports
that's
coverage.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
So what is your, you've written a number of them so far, but it's really just getting started. You mentioned some of the other ones that are kind of up. What, give me the top two or three, the favorite, now this is
off. Things
is
that
cold.
I've been at?
This is a cold question. You did not know I was going to ask you this.
Didn't.
So you're going to walk out of the room after we're done this. You're going to go, oh, I should have said that and that. But two or three of the favorite things that you've ever been at.
I you know, generally somewhere in my top five, and this has to be of things I'm at, right?
That's what I mean.
It's pretty hard to beat the 72 World or 72 Summit Series, but I wasn't at it, right? So I would say number one and two always vacillate. And this is about the event itself, not necessarily the stuff that I'm around, but the things that I saw. Probably was Mike Timlin shot putting the ball to Joe Carter at first base, which gave the Jays...
In Atlanta
in 1992, gave them their first World Series. Because I was also there at the first game, and I will write about this, in 1977. I can't believe there were too many people that were at that first game in the snow. I was there as a fan with my buddies, with a fair number of bottles in our parkas at the time for that first pitch.
Exhibition Stadium was dry at that point.
That's right. Exhibition Stadium was, it was the wettest it's ever been, but it officially was dry because they never checked anything. In fact, the same group of guys I went with, and I'd forgotten about this, and about 6 months, 5 months later became the first guys busted for bringing alcohol into the stadium. They just used to look another way. Well, my buddies brought a 24 in. They weren't even trying to hide it. So they got busted. So
yeah, and back then, you know what? The seats in this, and I don't know if what it was for the opening night, but you could go those first few years to see a Jays game for $2 out in the bleachers.
Out in the outfield and left field. So that would probably be my...
$2.
Yeah, I know, nuts.
Staggering.
And there was a time when it was a buck, when it was farther out, you know, way out into center field. You're actually way beyond the field.
My family is going to be in New York City in May. And we thought, oh, you know what? We should check the Yankees.
Oh, go away.
And go to see if the Yankees are home and maybe go to a game and take my son, who's a big baseball fan, go to Yankee Stadium. $60 for a ticket that is even within the same area code as... And $2 or $1 was the price when you...
What's getting killed by that, of course, was what... You and I talk about this all the time. The regularity of baseball, right? So you can't go to four games in a row like you used to. You can't go to, say, the last two games of one series and then the next two. Not at Yankee Stadium. Not for that kind of money, unless you're...
All right.
Okay, so number 92, and then 96, Bruni Surin passing the baton to Donovan Bailey. Now, Donovan had already won.
Yeah, the Atlanta
same place,
Olympics.
Saturday night in Georgia, in
yep.
Atlanta,
yep.
4 years later. And there was a lot of chirping about that time, and the chirping all came from the Americans, most of whom had raced here at Cops Coliseum for years as part of the old spectator game. So I'd known them from covering that. A lot of chirping, the whole thing about is Carl Lewis going to run again, and Carl's camp saying he should.
Well, the Americans had won every 4x100
that they'd finished. The only time they had was when they hadn't was when they dropped the baton.
Okay.
They'd never lost when they'd actually finished the race, and I was sitting on the corner of the third turn where the press saw. I get kind of seized up when I see this now, and you weren't sure, you know, how much were the Canadians into this? But as soon as he won the previous week, won the 100 meters, Donovan Bailey became part of that team. He forgot about his individual thing and really became a team guy. So he takes the baton, and the third pass is where the stagger is made up, and I'm right on that corner, but about 75 rows up. I swore when I saw it. First of all, I thought I had the wrong thing. I thought, the Americans are that much ahead? And I went, my God, that's the Canadians that are that much ahead. And then Donovan, the thrill of that. I'm an old relay guy. I ran in the Cap Cornelius relays when they were here at the stadium. I ran in the indoor games many, many years for my Toronto school. We were a big relay school. So I really understand that. So sometimes I think that's the number one because what it did... And you knew that there wasn't going to be any positive tests. It kind of finally erased the Ben Johnson thing.
See, I would, well, maybe you knew.
Yeah.
I can tell you, though, sitting back home, I did not know there was
not going to be a positive test.
After the whole Dubin inquiry and everything else, I can tell you, you may have been down there feeling good. Everyone back home was on
pins and needles, that's fair.
Waiting for 48 hours.
And
for
I think that's fair on your
back.
Part. I think because of the Dubin committee.
Yep.
Commission and it was the way that Donovan was so strong about something. Donovan rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, not me. There's something about him that
I still believe that had Ben Johnson never happened,
yeah,
Donovan Bailey would be in our top three Canadian heroes of
all time. You're 100% right because
but
it's always going to be
under
seen
that shadow of cynicism and skepticism.
Right.
Oh, he must have done something.
And the guy that really got ripped off on this, and I'll give Donovan credit because he spent half of that week talking about Bruni. Having been ripped off because Bruni was the world champion, but only 3 years after Ben, right? And so he never got the due because there was always this suspicion. Plus, he was winning these world championships just as the Dubin committee was shuffling things off. In the long run, especially when I look at what's happened in the last 25 years and the last 25 months in Russia, you have to be proud of Canada for the Dubin commission. I mean, we tend to eat our young. You know,
well, we ate them that
we really time. Ate them, you know, and we asked for salt and pepper and everything to add to it, and it was a period of self-loathing. The irony there is we're not far away from international athletics giving us this great self-pride, which would, you know, happened only 15 years later at the Vancouver Games.
All right, so now you've got to reduce everything else you've ever done in your entire career down to one more choice.
Okay.
One more play, one more thing that you attended that you'll be writing about at some point that you would put up. It doesn't have to be the thing, but one more that really stands out as being...
The Americans and Canadians in soccer at...
Wembley?
No, it was at Old Trafford.
Right.
And because they didn't get to Wembley because they didn't win that one. They would have played the final at Wembley. That would have been the back-to-back games.
And again,
there
this is
and
the 2012 London Olympics
right.
with Melissa Tancredi.
Melissa Tancredi just playing her heart out and really getting under the skin of the Americans. And so there was that one. And, of course, and then 2 days later they score. They should have won the game against the Americans, which would have put them in the gold medal game, and should have lost the game to the French, which gave them
was
their bronze.
Was it only 2 days later?
No, it might have been 3 or 4, actually. But it wasn't much longer than that, 3 or 4 days later, if it were that. It's
now,
a long
could you
tournament.
Tell, when you were there, you would have no way of knowing, could you tell that that game against the Americans completely changed the way women's soccer was perceived and followed and appreciated in Canada? Because it completely, overnight... Those women who were on that team became household names, and no one knew any of them before then.
I sensed it, and I sensed a responsibility, as did a couple of others. Most strongly, a couple of the Toronto writers who was covering it then, who now writes for the Globe and Mail, the columnist. He was covering
Cathal Kelly.
Cathal Kelly, and I had Melissa. I was just talking to her mother about it the other night. I had Melissa, and he had Sinclair. And we pressed them very, very hard, probably as hard as I've ever pressed anybody to comment. Melissa was able to, because she was a referee, to able to cite the rules, which is how she, I think, escaped suspension. But she was firm on it. Because I felt Canadians, because we didn't get...
This was the referee penalizing Canada for the Canadian goalie holding the ball for over 3 seconds.
3 seconds and giving
which
a...
Which never is called.
That's right. And then having a penalty shot that hit the hands that... which never should happen there. It was never called. Two things that were never called. And I give America... You forget there was a second team in that game, and the Americans, you know, they deserve a lot of credit because they're not used to falling behind. They fell behind 3 times in that game and came back. But Sinclair and Tancredi... Tancredi set up Sinclair twice for the first 2 goals on that. One of them was just a brilliant little loop. So, yeah, I think that one has to be right there. You call it... Your question, I guess, was... Was I aware? Yeah, because of the tweets we were getting back from Canada, that you could tell there was a telephone tag thing going on, that people were phoning people across the country, and momentum was building during that game. So because of that, I think the reporters felt an extra responsibility to get the Canadians to comment more than they might have liked to, you know. So and that's why we pushed so hard to get them to say controversial things, as I say, particularly Kelly and I, because it was important. For the readers at home, because they're now identifying with it, and they needed to identify with it in print as well. So I put that as number three. And that's surprising, right? I don't have Sidney Crosby's golden goal right there.
Sidney Crosby or another one that, you know, there's so many that come to mind. Donovan Bailey for racing Michael Johnson at Sky Dome.
Johnson at the Sky. I've been very lucky that way, you know.
There's
that
dozens.
Way.
Of it. Well, Steve will be doing this. It's called Being There. Read it every Friday in the spec. It'll be in the sports section. It'll be a look back at some event that you almost certainly would have watched since he was there. And then, just to, you know, for fulsome understanding, after you've read Steve and his Being There piece, go watch the movie Being There to fully round it out. Get Peter Sellers and Shirley
McClain. And if you've got any requests of anything that's happened in the last little while, that's one of Jeff's things. Write him in. Write him into the sports department or to me. Email him in.
Which is?
Smilton@thespec.com
Sorry, that's S.
Milton, yeah.
You're such a writer. You never explain these things. S. Milton, S-M-I-L-T-O-N @thespec.com. Smilton. No.
I know. You know, well, that's my nickname in the sports world.
I know,
world.
But you know who's going to be getting emails? Someone whose name is spelled...
Smilton, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway. So yeah, S. Milton@thespec.com. If you've got something you want Steve to write about that you think he might have been at, and he probably was, give him a shout. Steve, thanks for doing this.
Okay, Scott, thank you.
That's this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Graham. Thanks to Steve for their insights. We'll be back next week with another Spectator Newsroom Insider podcast and more great harp music. Stay tuned for that. Talk to you soon.